salad on the menu. We certainly hope that you recovered from Thanksgiving by now.
And I was just about to say that.
There we go.
First, well, I thought I would say,
go ahead.
Okay.
At first, you thought you should say, but I caught her.
Anyhow, diners and travelers of the world, you're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, post-prandial, right?
Yeah, we've recovered from Thanksgiving. It's at least several days away.
Yeah.
And we had a chance to visit with our son and wonderful daughter-in-law and two wonderful grandchildren, and we hope you had an equally good time.
Well, you had fun putting this program together.
Of course. Oh, yeah. Well, yes, I did. It was a sort of a cheeky combination of things.
It certainly is.
But first up for the first segment, soup. Soup is the order of the day, but soup in two very different ways. First of all, soup you can order for the one you love, if they're feeling sick or if you just want to give them a pleasant surprise. A really fascinating business development and a fascinating product you'll want to know about. And then a cookbook author who spends her life making soup, spends her life eating soup as well, she tells us, but she produced a wonderful book all about soup called Love Soup. I think you get the picture. So listen to these two ladies talk about soup, and then you'll be an expert. Or you're not an expert, you'll know where you can buy some without any difficulty. So a soup segment of On the Menu Radio follows.
Listeners, this falls in that category that you hear me mention every so often. Ooh, I wish this was my idea. We're talking to Marty Weimer, who has a brilliant idea, and that is if you have a sick friend, no matter how far away in the country, you can request and have her make and deliver for you fabulous homemade chicken soup. Now, Marty, you're going to have to bring us up to speed on how all of this developed. We were just thrilled to get a jar of chicken soup, homemade chicken soup, with noodles and chicken part, I mean the breast of chicken itself.
And we'll come back to the packaging and the ribbons later.
Okay. Okay.
Marty, go ahead. Tell us the
story.
Tell
us the story.
Well, I came up with the idea in October of 2007 when my mother was diagnosed with lung cancer. And the worst part about hearing the news is she lived thousands of miles away in Canada. I wanted to send her something to show her how much I cared, to comfort her, and flowers and fruit, candy, they just didn't seem appropriate for that situation. And so I thought, what do you send someone who is sick? And thought of chicken soup. So it's what she, like many mothers, used to make to comfort me. And so tragically, I lost her 6 weeks later. But out of that, I wanted to, in her honor, help other people that were in the same situation that I was in.
Now, the rumor that you had a large amount of chicken soup left over is not true, right? I just made that up.
Yes.
Peter is a huge fan of your chicken soup.
Well, I love that. So, and that's kind of just stuck. And it was one of those things that I was shocked myself. Why isn't there anyone doing this? Just something that's...
It seems natural, doesn't it?
Because everybody... It's just such a nice, like, meaningful...
You know, it's Jewish penicillin. You know, it's like... And of course, the name of company is Spoonful of Comfort, and
yes,
that's so appropriate too.
But you said you worked, you didn't just launch immediately, you ran a limited trial.
I did, just, you know, with friends and family I started. And, you know, of course, you always think your own ideas are wonderful, but, you know, I knew I wanted to test it a little bit, and before we kind of launched into this whole business. And what was happening is they would send a few orders to their friends, and those people would turn around and send to their loved ones, and it just grew organically from a small little local business here in Sarasota, Florida, and then before I knew it, I was shipping all over the country.
Now, before we came on the air, I deemed it a chicken soup chain letter.
Yes.
Seems like a kind of a good description of it. Now, I've got to sneak something in here, because for us guys, there's a little triumphal note in here, because the chicken soup recipe isn't yours, it's
kind of a personal joke in my household, because I'm actually a terrible cook. And so... Yes, so my husband is the cook in our family, and so he had quite a bit of input into the final recipe and what was going to be going out.
Oh, but you didn't make him give up his day job?
No. Not yet. So, not yet. I call him my official taste tester. So he doesn't mind that when there's testing new products and things coming along. So,
I mean, what's the process here? Somebody orders it online. You're online, huh?
Yes, online. Mm-hmm.
Okay, as soon as they order, you make the soup?
So what happens is, yes, it's made to order. So if you place an order today, it goes into the kitchen in Sarasota. And I actually have cooks who make it now at this level. There's just so much going out. And so I email them. I let them know I have this many orders for tomorrow. And then I go to the kitchen. I pick it up. It's all in the jars and everything all ready to go. And then right now my job is to make it look pretty. So when they arrive, they feel like they're getting a personal gift. That's the packaging and the experience is really important to me.
And that's yours.
Well, take our listeners through that, because from the moment you open the box, there's all this thoughtfulness. There's packaging materials, designs on them, and they're all color-coded to yellow. Why don't you describe it?
Okay. And it's a little difficult to try to make perishable food item to package that and make it look pretty. So I put a lot of thought in what that's going to look like when someone receives the package. So when you first open it, the first thing you will see is a big note card that's got a ribbon on it and a handwritten message. And that's my favorite part of all this, what I get, you know, to write the notes that people are sending to their loved ones.
You don't have to personally write
those.
Oh, yes,
I do. That's my favorite part.
Oh,
I personally write every note card that goes in there.
So people will tell you what message they want included.
Yes. And they tell me their messages. I write them on there. And then you'll have a nice, like you mentioned, a sheet with various colors depending on the season. That'll change or who's receiving it. So it looks like a wrapped package. And then within the box, of course, it's a perishable product. So I have to wrap the soup in bubble wrap and a special liner that keeps it fresh for up to 3 days. And so that is a special foil liner that I put a cute little sticker on. And then within that, the actual jar of soup, that's the trickiest part because it's glass. It was really important for me to have the old-fashioned mason jars. And so it's in that with a nice ribbon and a little tag. And on the tag, it says, made and sent with love to warm your heart.
That's
and so
cute.
That's on the tag of the soup that they receive.
Now what's
and then the rolls and the cookies are also have ribbon.
Yeah, they come with the dinner rolls and with cookies. Ours were pumpkin cookies.
No, I just wanted to emphasize the turnaround time. So you get an order today with a message. You ship tomorrow.
Right.
And delivery is
within two days.
2 days.
Mm-hmm.
That's absolutely wonderful. I mean, it's almost spur of the moment. It's almost as soon as you could make chicken soup for yourself.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and that was because, of course, depending on the situation you're sending soup for, I'm very sensitive to the fact, you know, if somebody's sick, we have to get it there while they're still sick. So that turnaround time is, you know, very important, like I said, and we're sensitive to that it gets there in a timely manner.
Now, what was your previous experience? What did you used to do?
I used to be in internet advertising. And so that was my background before I was then home with my children.
Oh.
Now, what comes next, Marty? Are you planning other products to cheer the
Absolutely. Really want to keep it very unique and personal and cozy and comfortable. So something we actually have we're getting ready to roll out that I'm really excited about are the inspirational coins to include in there. So it's just a nice little touch for someone to receive it's a little pewter coin that has various messages on it, like healing, faith, hope, serenity, comfort. So you can choose what best suits your situation to include that in there. And then we're also trying to find just the right blankets, throw blankets to comfort people, cozy socks, eye pillows, jammies. But I really want to make sure I do it right. So I don't want to rush it. I just want to find the perfect thing. I know it when I see it. And I probably should be moving a little faster adding those than I am, but I really want to make sure it's just the right.
Oh, no, you just launched this, right?
I mean, you
moved really fast, actually, you just launched it in January.
In January. Mm-hmm.
Didn't somebody write a book once called Chicken Soup for the Soul?
I've heard of that. Well, you know, a tiny little book that not many people had heard of. So that might be a nice touch to add those
in there. Yeah.
You better check out and make sure nobody did write a book of that by that title. I think they might.
Oh, no, they have.
So you might have to come up with something slightly different.
It's a series of books.
Okay. Anyway, this is just such a remarkable idea, and apparently it's taking off like wildfire.
It is. Thank you.
So we're so pleased that we were able to bring you to our listeners. And listeners, now you know, the flu season is coming, the winter season is coming. Make sure you keep the website handy so that you can respond when necessary. And Marty, why don't you give it to us so that people don't have to check it out?
Sure. It's www.spoonfulofcomfort.com.
Well, I wish you all the luck in the world.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, we appreciate talking. We appreciate the soup, and we love talking to you, and we love your idea. And you have one other twist to this whole project.
Yes, I don't want to forget that the most important part of it is $1 from every order goes to the American Cancer Society in memory of my mom.
That's great.
Thank you.
Thanks, Marty. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Anna Thomas is, I would say, renowned, Anna, wouldn't you, for your vegetarian recipes and cookbooks?
I think I have a pretty good following from my cookbooks. Yeah, it's been wonderful. I've had a good run. I feel lucky.
Yeah, and it's not even your day job, is it?
No, it's not my day job. I know. I'm a filmmaker, and I've been involved in producing and writing screenplays, and actually wrote my first book, The Vegetarian Epicure, when I was a student at UCLA in the film department there.
Well, thank goodness 36 years ago, at least you were a student. I was hoping you might be in grade school or something like that.
I was already heading into somewhere between undergrad and graduate school.
Well, now that you are, now you, why did you write the first cookbook?
It's an interesting thing about why you do things when you're a young person like that. I was learning to cook when I left home and went off on my own, and I had to survive, you know, so I started to learn to cook. I was a poor student. I couldn't afford to go out to eat. And also, I was becoming a vegetarian, and it wasn't an overnight decision. It wasn't like, okay, now I'm a vegetarian. I just was gradually eating less and less meat, and there wasn't at that time such a wonderful array of things for vegetarians to find out there. So I was cooking more and more, and I was finding that I was really enjoying it. And then I started to develop my own style. And really, the truth is, people started to say to me, oh, Anna, your food is really good. You should write a cookbook. Now, when you're 20 or 21 and people say these kinds of things to you, you think, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. I think I will, you know. question it. You think, I can do anything. And it doesn't occur to you that it might be hard or take a long time or be an enormous amount of work, or maybe you go to all that trouble and then nothing happens and you can't get it published, you know.
Yeah, but you
started writing a cookbook.
Yeah, but you managed to do that. And not only that, you had another one after that in 1978, and another one in 1995. And, of course, we're talking today because you produced another one with a very intriguing title of Love Soup.
Now, explain that, Anna.
I love this book. I just love this book. I love soup. I do love soup. And I'll tell you how this book came about is very interesting, because like many people, when my kids grew up and went to college, I downsized and I moved from a very big house to a much smaller place, and a place that in fact I needed to remodel and rip down. So I moved into the artist's studio that was attached to the property, and I sort of cleaned it up and put in a little temporary kitchen, and I said, well, this is nice, like living in a loft. I'll be fine here for a few months while I do the remodel. Well, anybody who's ever done a remodel knows that was an insanely crazy statement.
Yeah, much too optimistic.
3 years later, I was still in the studio with the little 81-inch kitchen. But what happened in that time was that I was in this temporary space with this little teeny tiny kitchen. All my fancy cooking equipment and all my special stuff was all in storage and packed away. And I still wanted to have good food. I still wanted to cook at home. It's something I really enjoy. I wanted to be able to have people over. I wanted to go to the farmer's market and get fresh produce and bring it home, just like I always did. And I found more and more and more I was turning to soup. And I just began to build little simple meals around soup. It was really a lot of fun. I'd send out an email, the soup kitchen is open, to a few friends, you know. People would come by, and it was like that pot of soup was kind of like a magnet. People would come over, they'd bring a nice loaf of bread or something that they'd baked, some you know, a tart for dessert, or somebody would pick up some wonderful cheese, and pretty soon we were having a party. And it became this very, very casual, very relaxed style of eating and of entertaining. And the more soups I cooked, the more ideas I had about them, and the more soups I started to invent. And I cooked through the seasons. And then I thought, I have to write a book about this, because soup is just saving my life again, you know.
Well, you have this quotation from Spanish in the front of the book that says, basically, there are only two things that count, love and soup is better.
It's a very famous old quote, Spanish quote, of love and soup, the first is better, or something like that. Yeah, and that's how the title came about. I thought, well, why choose between love and soup? Fortunately, we don't have to.
Yeah, there you go. You can have both. In fact, one's an expression of the other. I don't know which way you put it around. If you love someone, you make them soup, and if you make soup, they love you back.
That's right. Oh, that's a great way to put it.
We'll put that on the back of Love Soup Version 2.
Okay.
Now, you said you have soup on today, and it's early fall in California, but it's very hot. So what's brewing today?
Very hot, and so we're having zucchini and basil soup today, because everybody's gardens are still full of zucchini and big bushes of basil. This is a time of year in California when people are literally sneaking bags of zucchini to leave them on their neighbor's doorstep. And then you might bump into your neighbor who's sneaking to your house to drop off a bag of zucchini on your doorstep.
People just can't bear to throw them on the compost heap.
I know, because you look at them and they look so good and they're wonderful, but what are you going to do with all that zucchini?
Oh, yeah.
And you tend to have huge overgrown bushes of basil at the same time.
Yeah, we do.
And, well, there you go. You can make this soup. This is one of the easiest soups to make, too.
Now, is this a cold soup?
No, well, it can be a cold soup. Okay. But it's not really, it wasn't initially designed to be a cold soup, but I had it cold once with, I think, a little creme fraiche or sour cream or something on top, and it was wonderful. But I actually really like it hot. And it has zucchini, caramelized onions, and just a big bunch of basil. It has so much basil because over the years I found I was putting more and more basil into my zucchini soup. Mm. And after a while I thought, well, this is no longer a little herbal seasoning to zucchini. This is now deserves top billing with the zucchini in the soup. It's sort of like making spinach soup, only you're using basil. And it works so beautifully with a really good extra virgin olive oil and that basil and the onions and the zucchini. It's sort of like it really has a quality of a soup that has illusions of being a pesto, you know.
Yeah, you do that. That's probably part of your style here, as a lot of these are fairly thick pureed items. Talk to us a little bit about the organization of the book. It's organized according to the seasons.
Yeah, I cooked through the seasons when I was making this book, and I thought, I really do believe so much in seasonal cooking and in shopping at farmers markets and, you know, as much as possible eating fresh produce. That's the thing that's growing and good and plentiful at that moment. It really is what works the best. So I organized it loosely in seasons. And I did it loosely because people's seasons are different. So you don't want to say, you know, October, November, December. I mean, in some places right now, it really is fall, and it's cold, and it's time to be making black bean and butternut squash soup or a potato soup or something. But here in California, it's still summer. So
now, you have a lot of information here about what you need for equipment, what you need
to
shop. Also, you have recipes here for vegetable broths.
Yes.
I didn't realize there were that many kinds of vegetable broths, but
well, there weren't until I started doing them all. I really worked hard on that because broth is such an important thing to soup, and people pay a lot of attention when they're making meat stocks or chicken broth or something, but I don't think as much attention has been paid to vegetable broths, and they're very easy to do. I think I said in the book at one point, it's a little bit like making tea, only you're throwing a bunch of vegetables in the water instead of tea bag, you know? It is very simple to do, and you do not have to worry about how anything looks. You just chop things up roughly, throw them in with some water. go do your email or make a few phone calls, and 45 minutes later you have a lovely broth. It happens much more quickly than meat stocks. I mean, vegetables are so friendly. They just give it up for you in 45 minutes.
Now, tell me about freezing. Somebody once told me that you have to boil up all the broth that you freeze every 3 months to keep them from getting bacteria and stuff. Is this true?
I think it depends on how well you have, what the container is in which you've put your broth, and how cold, how really frozen your freezer is. But I can't really speak to that issue because I generally don't keep them longer than a couple of months.
Okay,
I tend to rotate through and use up my broth. I do freeze them, but I tend to use them up and keep going. I think it might be a good idea, but you'll probably be using them before that.
Yeah. Now, you have illustrations throughout, which are very lively. I was thinking that it probably is a better idea to do that rather than to photograph soup. The soup is hard to photograph, especially if it's brown.
Well, it's all going to tend to look pretty much the same.
Exactly.
Oh, you would be amazed at how beautiful. I've very often been told by people who are coming over for soup tastings that they should be photographed. And they will be. There will be certain magazine pieces and so forth, and there will be photographs. Some of these soups are so beautiful. You just would be...
Oh, okay.
You'd be amazed at how gorgeous they are. And I'll tell you another thing. Like a pureed green soup or a beautiful velvety squash soup. I like to finish my soups in the bowl. I like to... I really think that there are a lot of things that you can do at the last moment in the bowl that give you a quality that you cannot get any other way. And it's contrast. I like to drizzle a little extra virgin olive oil on top of the soup at the last moment and have that unheated, raw taste of the olive oil, which just lifts all the flavors and enlivens it.
You know,
I
have
entirely different taste. I like to drop a little few crumbles of cheese on top.
I already have a new recipe for you. Out of all these soup recipes, you don't have a broccoli soup recipe. Well, here's why I'm mentioning this. I mean, I wanted to point out that you interweave little stories, personal anecdotes, in with your recipes. And I'm looking at the one for pickle soup.
Uh-huh, yeah. That's one of my favorites.
Yeah, well, you talk about how when your mother was old and her health was failing, she lost her appetite and was getting too thin, so that you used this soup, pickle soup, to perk her up. Perk up her appetite.
Yeah.
And when my mother was dying, what I did was I made broccoli soup with pasta in it. And it was, you just take the broccoli, and I got down to the point where I was getting desperate because the season was passing. So I started even using leaves and stems or stalks. And you just add water to it, and you boil it. And then you add the pasta, and you boil that, and then you drizzle on extra virgin olive oil.
And
that's the only thing she would eat.
It really sounds very nice. It sounds like one of those very few ingredients, simple sort of dishes that if the ingredients are very good and very fresh, it's wonderful.
You know, I'm looking in here to see about your kale soup because we have a lot of kale to get rid of. What do you do with kale?
I love kale. And I use kale a lot. You'll find it, if you look in the index, you'll see kale. You'll see a number of listings. I have a sweet potato and kale soup, but I also have, I use kale a lot in the green soups.
Uh-huh.
And I have a whole chapter on green soups. It became sort of a cult when I first published the green soup recipe years ago in the LA Times. People started emailing me. It was incredible, the response to this green soup.
Now, we had a guest on just a couple of weeks ago who wrote a book about Portuguese cooking.
David Leith,
and
and
kale. I guess kale soup is a big thing in, I forget which part of Portugal they make kale soup.
All over, I think.
All over,
and
okay.
All over Portugal, and I actually talked to David a couple of weeks ago because we were both in Michigan for the Epicurean Classic.
Okay.
And I was having a nice chat with him. It's a lovely book that he did.
It is a lovely book. Yes.
Yeah. And wonderful. I said that one of the first influences for me in soup was when I was in college and on my very first trip to Europe, I got off the boat in Lisbon and had a bowl of caldo verde.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the kale or collard green soup that they make everywhere in Portugal. And, you know, it's one of the precursors to my green soup, which I make so many variations of now that I had to give it a whole chapter in this book.
Wow.
Well, listeners, get this. This book is really quite an amazing collection.
And there are also vegan recipes in here for those of you who are vegan.
Yeah, as it turned out, about two-thirds of the soups are vegan.
Yeah,
I bet you could probably sneak some meat in, and nobody would notice as well. But
I tell people to make the recipes their own.
There you go.
Ham hocks in your split pea soup.
Yeah.
But anyhow, I just think it's a wonderful book, and I think it's right on trend that a lot of people are just eating less and less meat lately.
I think that's true, and I think I never tell people you must eat this way or that way. I am myself not rigid about these things, and I don't think that does much good. But I try to offer people great choices that are delicious.
Well, I think you've done that, and we have a small number of cookbooks which live on the kitchen table, and I think yours is going to join the very few select ones which are there.
I'd be honored to join that company. Thank you so much. I'm thinking
of a very soupy fall. a soupy winter in Pittsburgh, and I hope that Anne will agree with me, and we'll make something together.
Here's to a wonderful soupy winter.
I once made, as a graduate student, not accustomed to cooking at all, I made one of my professor's lentil soup and had him for lunch, and his comment on the lentil soup was, "Don't worry about me, dear, I was raised during the Depression." So I haven't made that again, have I?
Well, lentils are good. Anne makes a fabulous wild mushroom soup.
Oh, yeah, that's my signature soup.
And you're allowed to put wine in soups if you're a vegan or a vegetarian?
Of course.
Of course.
Okay.
Well, this one has sweet vermouth, which makes all the difference in the world.
Yeah, I have a wild mushroom soup here that's the one I make every year at Christmas, on Christmas Eve.
Oh.
One of my favorite soups.
Is that in this book?
It is.
Okay, I'll look
for
that.
It's in the holiday section.
Oh,
and
great.
I love that soup.
Now, do you have a website that you'd like to give our listeners?
I do. I have a website, vegetarianepicure.com.
Okay.
And I'd be very happy to have people visit.
Well, would be happy to recommend people should visit your website. And they can also buy your book. It's listed on our website, too. So, I don't know. A delight to meet you.
A delight to meet you.
And maybe we'll run into each other at one of these food and wine festivals one day.
That would be great. That would be great. Thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed this.
Thanks, Anna. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
And now, after we've souped up our program, it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And please be sure to communicate with us. That's all I'm going to say about that now.
There you go, because we don't have to tell them to go to the homepage because they already know that.
Exactly.
But we do like to hear from you, even if Ann doesn't want to talk about it. I like to hear from you, too. And now what are we doing next?
We caught up finally with the Hazan son and the heir. And I really enjoyed talking to him. I mean, he had an extraordinary childhood
He's had an interesting life so far, which is far from over, and he's quite an expert on pasta, and he put together a wonderful book on the subject. So, pasta lovers, listen up.
Juliana Hazan, I've really been dying to meet you for quite a long time because you have such a fascinating background. We have the opportunity now because you just released a new cookbook called Juliana Hazan's 30-Minute Pasta. But let's jump back and look at it a little bit. But my fascination was you had an extraordinary childhood and development period, didn't you, with food?
I did. And, first of all, it's a pleasure to be on your show. Thank you for having me. I did grow up eating very well.
To say the least.
You know, yes. My mother, Marcella Hazan, introduced real authentic Italian cooking to America with her first book in 1973, and eating well was always a very important part of our life, and I always looked forward to meals, and I also always really enjoyed sitting in the kitchen and just watching my mother cook. I like to tell people that I think I learned how to cook through osmosis.
Now, did you grow up mostly in Italy or in the United States or some of both?
Kind of both. When I was little in Italy from age 2 until 8, and then afterwards all my summer vacations were spent in Italy, so at least a third of the year was in Italy, and I grew up really in both cultures.
In Venezia?
No, actually Venice came later. My parents moved to Venice when I was already grown up.
Oh, okay. So when did you, where did you live in Italy?
We lived in Milan most of the time and a little bit in Rome, but my family is from a region called Emilia-Romagna.
Oh, yes.
Bologna is its capital, and it extends to the Adriatic coast.
We've been there twice. We decided to go the last time on 2 weeks' notice.
Oh,
that's where you can eat
yeah,
well.
I got of all the amazing things, I got a phone call from the director, the general manager of a castle hotel on the southern fringe of Emilia Romagna. We had been to his place in Abruzzo a long time ago, and he was starting a new place. And he said, "You must come and see me." So I said, "Sweetheart," I said, "would you like to go to Emilia Romagna for a few days in a couple of weeks?" And she said, "Yeah, why not?" So it was one of the fastest trips we ever put together, and we had the most wonderful time.
Oh, great. That's wonderful.
Well, was it absolutely, there was probably no way that you could do anything besides food? I mean, weren't you sort of predisposed to having a culinary career?
I suppose I was. I didn't plan on doing it. In fact, originally I wanted to do theater, and I went to a professional theater school after college and did a two-year program there. But sort of inevitably, I ended up cooking as a career. So I think you're right. I was destined.
Now, you cooked in the restaurant business, Giuliana?
A little bit, yes, I did. My mother was a consultant for a restaurant in Atlanta that opened in 1990. And so I worked there for about a year to assist the chef and oversee the pasta production there. And then I also worked in a restaurant in Portland, Oregon for about a year.
Oh, what one? We just got back from there.
Ah, well, this was in the early 90s as well. And, and after having gotten my restaurant experience under my belt, I decided, well, I've done that. I want to do something else. So I started focusing on teaching, and that's when my first book came out, which was also a pasta book. It was called The Classic Pasta Cookbook. And when that came out, I just started traveling the United States, teaching classes at different cooking schools around the country.
Wow. I just read, by the way, one of the funniest things I read in a long time, your mother's reactions to, was it the Olive Garden?
Oh my
Did
God.
You read that? Where
well,
was that?
I mean, she told me about it.
Everybody should have that reaction to the Olive Garden. you get to understand the Olive Garden if you realize that it's actually owned by a British hospitality company called General Metropolitan or something like that. And as a result, it's really not surprising to find out the Italian food is really spoiled.
Well, it was quite a surprise to me when I heard that they decided to hire her to consult for them.
Do you think she improved it? Or?
I don't think there was that much that she could do.
I think you're probably right. So you decided to teach, and then you came out with a book, and then have there been several books?
Yes, actually, this last book is now my fourth cookbook.
Wow. Now, what made you write this one? I always think of pasta as a quick dish, anyhow, and you're implying that there's even what. You can do things easier?
Well, yeah, I realized that most of the pasta dishes I made at home really didn't take that much longer than it takes to boil the water and cook the pasta. And pasta is one of my favorite foods. It's something I really enjoy. And my first pasta book was very successful, fortunately now out of print. So I've been wanting to do another pasta cookbook, and I thought that... to focus on how quick and simple and easy it is was a good way to do it. And so that's how I came up with the concept.
Well, it's a real timely idea. I mean, we read increasingly people have less and less time to cook, less and less time in the kitchen, but yet with economic circumstances, the requirement to perhaps financially eat at home more than they would have in the past. So it seems like a very timely thing. But there's some lead time in books. So were you just forecasting the future, or were you just...
Maybe for once I was actually clairvoyant.
You were ahead of the game a little bit.
It's never going to happen again, but...
No, I did threaten before we came on the air to ask you the question about pasta that's always interested me, the difference between fresh pasta that you make at home or that you buy from somebody who's just made it, and dry pasta, and perhaps you'd like to comment on the merits of the two different kinds.
Well, there are really two different kinds of pasta. One is a flour and water pasta. That's the kind of pasta that we always buy. In fact, in Italy, we refer to it as store-bought pasta or factory pasta. And the other is egg pasta, and egg pasta is the kind that is best made at home by hand. But the term fresh is actually misleading because it doesn't really matter whether it's actually fresh. If I'm going to make egg pasta, I'll make a larger batch, and I cut it into whatever shapes I want, and let it dry. And once it's dry, it keeps very well for months. So it really doesn't matter if it's fresh. It does matter if it's homemade and handmade, because it is better. But for the concept of this book, I decided, well, let's assume that, didn't want to eliminate the sauces that go well with egg pasta, but let's assume that maybe somebody has some, you know, that they've already made and they're ready to be used, or let's say you're fresh out of your homemade pasta, you can buy now quality dried egg noodles as well. What I wouldn't do is go and buy that, quote, fresh pasta from the refrigerated case.
Now let me just add a comment there and ask you to see what you think about this, because we had the opportunity to visit with Gianluigi at Rusticella Pasta. We went to the factory, we went out to dinner with the owner, and we ate, of course, three or four different kinds of his pasta, and he had something interesting to say. He said, I would put my pasta up against anybody's homemade pasta, however good it is, and the reason is because my process is so scientific and so precise that when I produce an egg pasta, but that's dry, I know that will always be the same. The difficulty with fresh pasta made at home is that it might be different from one day to the next. Consistency is an enormous value.
Yeah, but it has to do with the timing of cooking more than anything else.
Well, I mean, that's certainly true. It is going to be always a little bit different when you make it at home. So, he's right.
So he's a pretty smart guy anyway.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Tell us how you organize this book.
I decided to organize it according to sauce type. In other words, whether it's a meat sauce or a seafood sauce or a vegetarian sauce. Uh-huh. And what's interesting is that the vegetarian chapter in the book ended up being the biggest one. In fact, about half the book is of sauces that are just with vegetables.
Yeah, that was just the way it turned out?
I didn't plan it from the beginning, but I noticed that the greatest number of dishes that I was doing were ones that were vegetarian rather than meat dishes. I think, you know, for the quick concept, that you're much more likely to make a vegetable sauce. Small section on soups.
Now, were these pastas the recipes that you were creating because you were doing the book, or were they pastas you were cooking just because you were exploring pasta in general?
Well, it was a combination of both. I resurrected dishes that I had made, you know, just, you know, to prepare dinner at home and that I liked, and so when I make something that I like, I make a note of it and file it away for further use, and then... I took those out when I was making this book and used the ones that fit the concept of the book. And then, of course, I also, you know, came up with new ideas for this particular book.
I ask everybody who's a pasta expert that we have on the show this. When I was growing up, since my family was Sicilian, they had a pasta called Pasta Indiana. And it was essentially pasta with, and I think it was just long spaghetti is what I think. And then you had on the top of it sautéed cauliflower, fennel fronds, garlic, and there was something else.
Well, it's named after the state of Indiana, which is in Sicily. That must be the reason
but
why.
I just keep asking, did anybody ever...
Yeah.
Did anybody ever... You didn't run across it either? Nobody else has ever run across that.
Well, it sounds like a...
Onions. It was onions, cauliflower, fennel fronds, and garlic.
Well, it sounds like a recipe combination that Juliana recognizes. It's just not called pasta Indiana, and... Who knows why it was called pasta Indiana? It probably doesn't have anything to do with where it came from in Italy.
I don't know. I never heard of the name, I have to confess.
But you've heard of the recipe.
The flavors sound familiar and definitely sound like something that you would have in Sicily.
Yeah.
Now, where do you come down on the side of the fence about how much sauce you should put on the pasta? We've had a number of people point out that Americans like way too much sauce on their pasta.
Right.
And when you go, of course, to... the Olive Garden, you can get as much extra sauce as you want. And we all think that's sort of a great idea, but the Italians feel differently about it.
Well, it's not. The rule of thumb is that you're supposed to be eating pasta with sauce. The sauce is supposed to season the pasta. And it's not the other way around. You're not eating sauce and, you know, putting some pasta in it like you might dip a little piece of bread in a bowl of sauce. So... it's really a complete dish, and when you have too much sauce, it overwhelms the pasta, and I don't think it tastes as good.
I don't either.
Okay,
so
you definitely come down on the Italian side of the fence.
Yes.
Me too.
Now, we had that other discussion about the dyes that are used for dry pasta.
Right.
The difference between the ones that are made out of, is it brass?
With brass.
And that have grooves.
Right.
So that you get
burrs.
So you get sauce-friendly pasta, which actually sticks to the shape, versus the, shall we say, the ugly brands like Kraft, and, well, let's not just pick on them, there must be others, who use plastic dyes where the pasta is very smooth and the sauce doesn't stick at all.
Right, yes, I'm used Teflon, too.
Teflon. I said plastic, but I meant Teflon. So obviously you think that extruded in bronze is so much superior.
It is. I mean, it adds texture to the pasta, too. And the pasta itself is not something that doesn't matter what it is. It's important. It's important that it contribute flavor to the dish and texture. So that's why using those premium brands of pasta is really important.
Well, now they incorporate flavorings in the pasta itself. I mean, how many truffle flavored pastas are there, you know, all the other red pepper pasta and all kinds of stuff.
I have to say I'm not a huge fan of that idea.
Okay.
I prefer to add that flavor to the sauce or to the pasta. You know, if I want to eat pasta that has a truffle flavor, I'd rather use a good quality plain pasta and then put some nice flavorful truffles on it.
Sounds good to me.
It sounds to me like you're a traditionalist at heart, Juliana, which I suppose is probably inevitable and was just handed down through the generations.
Juliana, about your recipes here in this book, I mean, you didn't just confine yourself to one region. Did you do all the regions, or how did you do that?
I didn't confine myself to a specific region. On the other hand, it's not as if I set out to include all the different regions in Italy. What was more important is just to put in dishes that I like, that are flavorful to me, that are simple, quick to prepare. And so there were quite a few recipes that I tried out and I wasn't too thrilled with. I didn't really like them that much. So they made
it to the cutting room floor, huh?
Exactly.
Well, I think your organization makes a lot of sense. After all, if you're cooking in the United States, does the region of Italy that the recipe comes from matter? Seems to me it's more important to know whether you feel like fish or vegetables or meat tonight with your pasta, and that's the way you've organized the book.
That's true, and that is, you know, how I think about it. You know, if I'm thinking about, what do I feel like, you know, making? I want a pasta dish, what kind do I want? And it'll be either seafood, or maybe I want a meat dish, or maybe I just want a pasta with vegetables.
Well, you have some startlingly intriguing... different recipes here. I'm looking at spaghetti with melon. No, I've never had anything like that.
Well, it's actually not something that I made up. This is a dish that I remember having with my parents in a restaurant in Venice. It was an unusual restaurant because it had neither risotto or fish on the menu, which are, of course, kind of the two staples in Venice restaurants. But it had a lot of meat dishes and unusual dishes. This was one of them, and I like to make it for company and have them try and guess what the secret ingredient is.
You can't taste it? Or?
It does. You can't. Most people don't figure it out.
The melon you use is cantaloupe. The only thing that comes, I remember having pumpkin.
We were at that place in southern Tuscany. No, it was peachy. That's spaghetti.
Peachy.
And we were trying to understand whether, Anne speaks quite good Italian, but doesn't know every word. And the owner of the restaurant didn't know how to explain it in English, so he finished up taking us to the kitchen and showing us this gigantic pumpkin, apparently whenever pumpkin was in season, they always made this pasta, and it didn't matter whether you ordered it or not, you got some.
Right. Yes.
And it was extraordinarily good, but we couldn't figure out the flavor, eluded us, and I think your melon pasta must be the same.
I'm going to try that one, Giuliano. Let's once again repeat the title of this book and encourage our listeners to get it. It's called Giuliano Hazzone's 30-Minute Pasta, and what it is 100 quick and easy recipes by you with your touch on it, and it is fast, easy, and delicious. Thank you so much for sharing all this with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Great. Tell us when you're doing your next book.
Okay, I definitely will. Love to chat with you again.
Thanks, Giuliano. Ciao.
Ciao, ciao.
And it's time for another pause.
For the cause.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're about to be introduced to yet again another important book to add to your cookbook library. It's called Classic Lebanese Cuisine, and it's eye-opening, I must say.
Yeah, you'll be amazed. You'll be amazed if you think of the country of Lebanon only as a result of it being in the news because of all the nasty war things that are going on. You'll be absolutely surprised and delighted by our next guest.
Well, here we are. Welcome on the menu, Chef Kamal Al-Faqi. Did I do that right?
That was great.
It was better than the first time we tried.
Well, that's why I always call, because I always call and ask, would you like me to pronounce my name?
Well, you have this wonderful, wonderful book out called Classic Lebanese Cuisine. 170 fresh and healthy Mediterranean favorites. And I don't know how, I'm sure you're a wonderful person, but I don't know how you could go wrong with a subject like this.
Thank you. Well, thanks.
So tell us a little bit about your background.
I'm the youngest of four boys. I was born and raised in Washington, D.C. My parents to Washington, D.C. in the early 50s. They got married, and 2 weeks later came to Washington and started their family. And my parents used to entertain a lot when we were children. My dad was with the embassy, so my mother would do all the cooking. And I was the youngest, and I was sort of in the kitchen as her little helper. And I think that's where it really all started. And then in the 80s, my mom and my aunt and I opened a catering company.
Now, by now, you've glossed over the events that took place in your native land.
In my native land, right.
In the decades in between.
I left that out, sorry. At six, studying for when I was six, so beforehand they took my brothers as well, we started going back to Lebanon. And we would spend the summers, it would usually be my mom would take the kids and we'd go to Lebanon. And actually that was very fortunate for me because I got to this day meet a lot of relatives, but I saw all of the cuisine being prepared there. And it was always about lots of meals, and even back then, you know, all my family would come back up to the mountains. We'd always have a big lunch every day. and I really got to cook and see a lot of cuisine and the regional foods there. So I think I was very fortunate to be able to travel back and forth for many years until I opened the company.
Well, Lebanon is used to be a wonderful little country, and unfortunately it's gotten in the way of a whole lot of conflict that didn't originate in Lebanon in between, isn't
right,
it?
Right.
There were recent flare-ups again. I guess, in a way, you're very fortunate to see a Lebanon that you knew you might almost never see again.
I think there is a Lebanon that I might not see again, but there's a Lebanon now that newly sort of revived. I think what's always remarkable about Lebanon and the Lebanese people is they just keep reviving. And the country, again, is the whole city center has been rebuilt. Perhaps over the years you've heard of Rafik Hariri, who really had a lot to do. Unfortunately, the poor man was assassinated, but he had done a lot. He brought so much construction and revitalization to the downtown city center of Lebanon, which I have not seen, which I'm hoping next summer I'm going to make a trip back.
But anyway, let's go back to the food, because
the food will live on.
Yes, absolutely.
It will live on thanks to people like yourself.
Well, thank you.
So I looked through the book, and I said, if I didn't see Lebanon on the front, I might think this was Greek, or I might think it came from
Syria.
A number of other places
around
Lebanon. Lebanon itself might be the last place I would think of. So stake a claim. Will you say these things were really invented in Lebanon first and the other people copied it?
I don't know that I'm going to say that, but I think that there are a lot of similarities in the cuisine throughout the regions. And I think what sort of uniquely identifies Lebanese cuisine is that we're very well known for what is known as meza. And it's sort of like a Lebanese tapas. And they are small finger foods, and they come in a variety of shapes and textures. And we have grape leaves, which we call wadaina. The Greeks have dolmades, which is the same thing. So I think there's different variations on the food. The Lebanese have our variety. I'm sure that the Greek people, and there's similarities such as like the yogurt salad. The Greek, they call it tzatziki. We call it leban khiyar. The Persian people have another name for it. Even Indians, they call it rayata. It's the yogurt cucumber. So I think there are a lot of similarities, but what separates Lebanese is our meza, and then the certain grains and the fresh vegetables and dishes that we prepare.
Right. Well, I'm just looking. You use pomegranate seeds, and Peter said that he had on his fruit for breakfast. And last night we had garbanzo beans.
Right.
Yeah, we must have been.
So you see, you're eating all this wonderful, actually very nutritious, especially the pomegranate, really very good. They tasty and happen to be, I think what's nice is things that we incorporate into our cuisine are really high on the sort of heart's healthy list.
Now, lentils are big, right?
And then lentils are.
And then I was reading about this particular kind of fava bean that's so good, it has its own name.
It's so good. Fort Hook. Which one? The Fort Hook? No,
the Fort
fava
Hook,
bean.
No, the Fort Hook, I mean, it sounds like.
Fort Hook lima beans. It's funny because I was doing, in Southern California, where I live now, that I was doing these, I do these cooking demonstrations where about four or five couples meet at somebody's house, and I come in, and they prepare the meal that they've selected, and I suggested that they make these Fort Hook lima beans to go with part of the meal, and they said, we don't like lima beans, and I said, these aren't lima beans, these are Fort Hook lima beans. And they were like, what does that mean? I said, just trust me on this one. And they could not believe it. It was, you know, because they are, like, they're large, and when you cook them, they're just little creamy pads of butter when they cook up, and we make it with cilantro and garlic and a tomato with olive oil, and they're really, really quite good.
Now you use a lot of cilantro, don't you?
Yep, we do. We use cilantro. A lot of the dishes are flavored with cilantro, mint. Of course, everything's cooked in olive oil.
Well, a lot. You have photographs, of course, throughout, but you even have photographs of cutting techniques.
Yes.
And the other thing is, I've noticed that it seems to me that presentation is much higher on the priority scale in Lebanese cooking than in a lot of other cuisines.
You know, that might be, I think that's also the caterer in me.
Okay.
I think that the reason I had the photos with the decorations is that in case some people were uncertain of exactly how they might decorate something like hummus or baba ganoush, the smoked eggplant. Uh-huh. At least with the book, I have a, when the book is purchased, I have a website which is Shop Kamel where people can buy the book. If they buy it, you know, there's also, of course, every venue of national bookstores and online, but I have a DVD with tutorials so that if you've never rolled grape leaves before, I have a DVD that shows you. And I also have all of them loaded on YouTube so people can go to Chef Kamel 1 and see all these tutorials, which I think would help in preparing. It's very important to me to try to share with people not only the recipes, but how to prepare some of the things that might be things that they've not prepared before.
Yeah, I happen to be I did some recent work in the Arlington, Virginia area of Washington, D.C., and I was staying at a hotel, and there was a Lebanese restaurant right across the street. It was the closest restaurant away. It was called FJ's or something like that. So I thought I would try it, and they said it was contemporary Lebanese cuisine, but it seemed to come out pretty much the same as the kinds of things that are in your book.
Okay, good.
But I did have to admit that a couple of the dishes looked sort of rather uniformly brown.
Yeah, I've not heard of that. I don't contemporary Lebanese.
I think that's what they called it. I actually had a lamb shank as my main course, which didn't sound real contemporary and actually tasted really quite good. But I was commenting really about the appearance, because you go to a great deal of trouble to create food which is very attractive, when if you didn't put the ingredients together in the way you do, it might look rather dull.
Right. I think that'll help people. I think we all sort of look at something and we sort of, and I think also with the photographs, for 6 months before I even started to write the book, I had a test group of about 60 friends and family. And the one thing that everyone agreed on is that they want photographs. They want to see what the food is supposed to look like at the end. And they want to sort of visualize what dish. I think it was important for this book especially because I think it's still undiscovered Lebanese cuisine. I think some people are familiar with it while others are just, it's a question mark to them. And I'm hoping that I can sort of open the door and share this really wonderful cuisine and how easy it can be to prepare. So, you know, you could even prepare some side dishes. It doesn't have to be an entire meal. They're wonderful salads. So I'm hoping that I'll get an opportunity to really bring this into a lot of homes.
Well, I could just gobble up everything in this book. Well, it looks
that's
so
a good
insight,
then.
She's drooling on the book.
Don't drool on the book.
Stop drooling on the book. The pages will stick together.
Oh, dear. Now, tell us again your website.
I have a www.cookingwithkamel.com. And on that website, people can go there. I have 5 recipes from the book on that website. And it also it describes of my journey of what brought me to the day of writing the book. And it gives information about my travel schedule and information about Lebanon. And then I have another website because, again, with the 60 people who were testing the recipes, several of them brought this one item that I thought was a good point, was what if they can't find some of the specialty ingredients?
Yeah, it was one of them, not hemp, it was some other kind of thing.
Right, you might not be able to find it, or even your specialty market might not have it. And so I thought, as opposed to making people try to go out and navigate the internet and find it, I have a www.shopkamel.com.
Oh, that's clever, Chef.
I thought it was a great idea when they said it. And I thought, you know, that's such a great idea because that'll make it even more accessible. And that way, if you want, and I tried to really make it friendly in the sense, so if you want to try something, you can just buy a jar of this or a pound of that, and it's all pre-sealed, and it's a lot of it's imported from Lebanon. So I'm hoping that this, again, will be a way that I've just tried to make it accessible and reachable if you don't find it. But a lot of these things, actually, now you'll find in local Middle Eastern markets and things like tahini now. Tahini,
oh, yeah.
Which is the pureed sesame seed paste.
Yeah, you've been able to
you
get
can
that
find that
years.
In so many markets
yeah.
now.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and the pomegranate molasses now is showing up. Orange and rose waters are showing up in markets. So I think it's just a matter of time that more and more these things will come to market.
Yeah, isn't that shop down the road, that little convenience store, isn't that Lebanese? Isn't he Lebanese?
I don't know. I don't know. Most exotic thing I ever bought there was pomegranate juice. So I don't know that he really stands for anything in particular.
Oh, I was going to say, yeah, because now pomegranate, it's funny, pomegranate juice is everywhere.
Oh, yes. Well, you have to actually make my own pomegranate juice to marinate duck breasts in.
Right.
And yeah. Now you go buy it in a bottle.
Absolutely. I used to make a big mess.
I remember when there wasn't yogurt in the... I mean, there really wasn't yogurt in the stores. My mom, as a child, my mom used to make all our yogurt.
Yeah, well, I used to make it, too. I had a Syrian culture, by the way.
Yeah.
That had existed for years.
Wow.
And brought over to the U.S., and
illegally, one might add.
Well, we've all done that once.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, and then we went on vacation, and the person I left to care for it let it die.
Oh, no.
Yeah, but it was the best yogurt I've ever had.
Well, Chef Kamal, you must keep in touch with us. I'm sure you'll have some new adventures that you'll want to tell us all about.
Well, I would love that, and thank you. Thanks so much.
It's a lovely book. Congratulations.
Well, thank you. Well, I appreciate it.
Yeah, could you come cook for us instead of my doing it?
Sure. I'd love to.
Great. Thanks a lot, Kamal.
All right, then.
Bye-bye.
Be well. Bye.
So, let me recline on these cushions, silk cushions, I might add, while you pop pomegranate seeds into my mouth. Ha, ha, ha. I'm just kidding.
Oh, okay. Is that what we're doing? Is that Lebanese cuisine? I didn't realize
it
that.
It sounds like it. It's such a sensuous cuisine.
Maybe that was the Kama Sutra or something like that. But it's a story for another day. And we'll talk about that next week. Perhaps we won't. But we'll certainly hope to see you same time, same place.
Bye-bye.